Okay. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Chitra Kumar Sai, who agreed to be interviewed. So Chitra is a data scientist at Envista, and Envista is a part of Koch Industries. And I'm Leigh Green, and I run IRI's research and strategic initiatives. And this interview is an element of IRI's digitalization program. And we aim to help out companies on your journey towards digital transformation and integration. And through this programming, you can access case studies with fresh, relevant content. We do facilitate roundtable discussions on key topics. We'll be having our monthly one tomorrow. If you'd like an invitation, just let me know. We do updates with additional insights and resources and webinar interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. Next month, we will be back on our normal schedule of the third Thursday of the month, and we'll be talking to Professor Becca Willett from the University of Chicago on her AI research. And I'll be sure to sign all of you up for updates if you aren't already on the mailing list. So just a few housekeeping items before we get the conversation with Chitra started. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there won't be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all of your questions until the end, and I'll let you know a few minutes beforehand so you can start getting them in. Once we open the floor to questions, you can either raise your hand and you can then come off mute and ask the question face to face, so to speak, or you can just type it into the chat and I'll read it out for you. All right, all the boring stuff is out of the way. Chitra, thanks again for agreeing to be in the hot seat today. And I should warn everyone, sure, we are going to get into the weeds of how all of this works. We're very excited. So high level, we want to know how this is actually going down at Envista. So Chitra is the guy for that. So tell us about your background and Envista itself, please.
Sure. First of all, thank you everyone for joining this session. So my name is Chitra. I'm a data scientist at Envista. I have a bachelor's degree in electronics and communication engineering and a master's degree in computer science from Wichita State University. I basically come from India. That's where most of my education happened. And when it comes to Envista is we are a big materials company and we are a part of a larger organization called Koch Industries. What we do is that we create chemicals, materials, fabrics, and fibers that are strong and can handle life's challenges. It takes, definitely we as a team take efforts of our talented employees to make these products. And we are always looking for people who can help us come up with new solutions in the life's big needs. Being a part of a larger organization, we share our ideas, solutions, or any problems with other Koch companies. We also pitch ideas and solve problems that we have through participation in Koch-wide community gatherings and meetings. So this is a way for us to work together and find innovative solutions. So that's the holistic short note on myself and Envista.
Okay, great. And so where do you sit at Envista?
So I'm part of a IT department within Envista, and we are a team of four members who report to the data science leader. Okay. So yeah, it's a part of a broader IT organization.
All right. Mm-hmm. So you've been working on a lot of different AI projects at Envista. Yes. So we're going to walk through them and you're going to share some examples of, you know, how they're actually being applied and how it's useful for people. So let's start with natural language processing. How are you doing this? What's going on with that?
Yeah. So natural language processing, I mean, natural language is nothing but handling text kind of data that is in textual format. So here we utilize, within Envista, we use something called, within natural language processing, there are various techniques. So I generally work on text classification. So in this approach, what we do is that we assign text to one or more specific categories to effectively organize, structure, and filter it based on various criteria. So to give you a good example, I cannot definitely give you the concrete underlying example that I'm working on, but I'll give you a good idea of how this actually works. So we collect a lot of data that is both important and not important for us. And then we train various machine learning models that are open source. There are various open source platforms like scikit-learn, and also we have large language models that also perform classification. So we take this data, we convert them into numbers, which is nothing but the conversion of text to numbers is called embeddings. So we take the embeddings and we train the model on these numbers. And once it is effectively trained, it kind of remembers the concrete or the necessary information of this text. And once we give this trained model a new set of input text, which could be relevant or irrelevant, we do not know, right? When the new information is fed into the model or given to the model, it automatically takes the input from the knowledge that it has had during the training. It gives us the output based on the model that it's being trained on. So that's how the natural language processing works, or the technique that I use at my organization.
Okay, and have you been using it? How have other people been using it once you get them on board with
Correct.
It?
So we definitely have various requirements. So at the end of the day, it all depends on what our stakeholders need. So in the text classification aspect, most of the data that we train on is given by the stakeholder, and we send out the results of the output from the model to the stakeholder. He then reviews them and manually checks if it is relevant or not, if the model that spilled out the results is relevant or not, is being manually tested by the stakeholder. If there is any discrepancies in the model performance, we take that feedback from the stakeholder and we retrain the model by taking these feedbacks and retraining the model on those feedbacks. So that's how the current methodology is, but we are looking to automate this process through it's a methodology called MLOps. Through that process, we will be able to automate this entire manual process of manual structure where the stakeholder manually goes through it, updates it. So this everything will be eliminated once we deploy the MLOps architecture.
Okay, and so how is that feeding into your work with LLMs?
So LLMs, when you're working with any text classification or text particular text problem that is aligned with text, the pre-processing steps are very similar. Like you have to always clean the, so text can be of various, text can come in various forms, right? It could be PDFs, it could be words, it could be Excel files, it could be some kind of an image, like an OCR document where the text is in form of an image. So you have to, at the end of the day, you have to take all these inputs or data sources and you have to refine them by eliminating, the text can have frequently used words. You do not want to have those frequently used words to change the meaning of the sentence, and you don't want the model to be trained on the words that are frequently used, because they become, so once your model is trained on the frequently used words, what happens is that whenever it sees those frequently used words, it thinks that it makes sense to our use case and tries to trigger any text that has frequently used words as a positive statement or a positive result. We don't want that. So we eliminate frequently used words, as well as we remove words that do not contribute to the overall meaning. We also have various packages that rectify the spellings. So we do all these kind of pre-processing on the text data. And this pre-processed text is given to a large language model. And once it is given as an input to a large language model, at the end of the day, we can modify these large language models to, or you can have various kinds of prompts on top of these large language models to generate summaries, provide insights, and also help us identify what are some of the important keywords that the stakeholder might need in the text, and also address any other questions like what are the differences between various PDFs, various data sources, and also how they, and it can also help us in research as well, right? So for example, there are a lot of research documents, and all our scientists sometimes might find it difficult to go through each research article. So what we do is that we pre-process the text research articles and feed it into the LLM model, and we kind of build a chat interface. And through the chat interface, our research scientists can ask various questions and get answers accordingly. It can also provide insights and other experimental procedures depending on various, it all depends on the type of data sources that they give. So that's one of the use cases that we as a team are currently working on. We have done a small POC on it, but very soon we could see a project coming in.
That must have taken a long time to be able to get enough of the research data in there to be able to have it be meaningful for people.
Yeah. Invista has been there for a very long time, and many of our scientists have read a lot of research articles, they did a lot of research, and they saved a lot of documents in their through the process of their research. So we definitely have enough data, so which is a positive sign for us. So it did not take us a long time, but the only thing that takes a lot of time is the pre-processing techniques, because PDFs should be handled differently. Word documents should be handled differently. Excel files have to be handled differently. So each document type needs a different pre-processing technique. So that's the major pain point or the task that takes very long time. But once we have that, feeding into LLM and making LLM do the magic is relatively quick.
Okay, and we're going to come back and talk more about data in a little bit, but sure. I want to move on now to computer vision. So how do you have AI working with images? Because that's a huge issue, obviously.
Yeah, so definitely computer vision is one of the complex tasks when it comes to AI. So you have to have, so each image needs to be processed differently in computer vision. So generally there are various ranges of image pre-processing techniques. So if the image contrast is very low, there are various packages in Python, or Google has given us various techniques like TensorFlow, and there is an open source library called OpenCV, where when the image contrast is very low, you can manage image contrast through those libraries. Also, you can adjust brightness. You can also crop the images and do many things. You can twist image. You can adjust the ratio of the brightness. So there are various pre-processing techniques. At the end of the day, in my use case, I had to, I worked on a use case where I had to monitor it's a level monitoring system where I had to monitor whenever a certain material reaches a certain level, I need to notify the stakeholder saying that so-and-so material has reached so-and-so level, and I wanted the stakeholder to be notified. So the images were of various shapes, and we had to train the model on various directions. Sometimes the images were captured during the snow time, sometimes during the night, sometimes during various times during the day. So I had to do a lot of pre-processing. As I said before, I had to manage image contrast, adjust the brightness, cropping image, rotate an image, zoom out or zoom in an image. So I've done all the required pre-processing on the images. Then I've taken all these images, trained them using various machine learning models, and then used. And now it's similar to the text classification problem. Now, instead of text classification, here we have image classification. So once the model knows which image is important and which image is not important from the training data that we have, once we take a new image that is unknown to the model and give it as an input based on the historical information that it has from the training that is being provided, it spills out the results accordingly based on the input of the image. So definitely dealing with images is complex, but yes, we were able to solve it through these processes. And also we have leveraged state-of-the-art models from AWS called AWS Lookout for Vision, which ultimately solved our problem holistically with greater accuracy. The AWS Lookout for Vision is a system where it's being trained on millions and trillions of images on a text classification, on an image classification use case. So that model requires less than 50 images for you to trigger or perform any image classification task.
And so what are the use cases that you're seeing with all these images?
So it depends on when it comes to image, there are various use cases. The use cases that I worked on is on classification, but there is image segmentation, image object localization, and also there is object detection, right? So if you want to detect an object within if you want to detect a dog within or on a street where we have vehicles, humans, etc., traffic lights, you can have a system where it detects. If you have a system where you have millions and millions of images or hundreds of images, if you're using Lookout for Vision, which has dogs in it, you can train it with those images and you can have it in your use case. But in our industry, I would say in general, if you want to identify any defects in a system or in a conveyor belt, for example, if you want to identify any defects, maybe we use computer vision models on that to perform classification or image segmentation.
Okay. And so moving to another use case, it's kind of related. So root cause analysis. So can you share what you've been doing with that and how that works?
Sure. In our work, we leverage machine learning techniques, to uncover the factors that have most significant influence on our final outcome. So to identify a root cause of a particular issue, we employ a variety of non-linear and tree-based models. So these methods involve training the model on data collected both before and after the problem occurred. Then the model's role at this point is to determine which specific feature or factor contributed to the change in the output or result. So to give you a brief understanding, once you train your model, once the data is collected before and after a particular issue, and once the model is trained on it, you'll have a variable or a set of variables that significantly contributed your output to change, right? So so machine learning models always look for patterns in the data. So whenever the pattern changes, a particular factor or a variable will definitely show more influence on the final outcome. So we use that respective variable and we investigate on those variables to see if that respective attribute or variable is the actual cause for the problem or not. So that's how I generally do root cause analysis. And there are also various statistical techniques like p-statistics and also comparative statistics, analysis of variations, ANOVA techniques on the data coming from a similar distribution. So we perform all these statistics to see how the final outcome variable has been impacted based on the factors that have changed on the input variables. So that's how we were able to pinpoint on the root cause when an issue has occurred.
Okay. Are you able to share any examples of when it's gone well? Or maybe it's gone badly. You can share that too.
I don't think I can give you most of the projects that I work on are pretty highly confidential, so maybe I cannot share. But if I have to give you a good example, root cause analysis. So imagine you have a puzzle, right? And you have been training, you have captured a number of images on that respective puzzle, but someone has changed the direction of the puzzle, right? So now when you give the image of the puzzle with the changed direction, definitely when that respective image is given as an input to your already trained model on a perfect scenario, it definitely considers the position of, different pixels. There is always a change in the pixel, right? So once you move an image to a certain direction, it obviously changes the image contrast, right? So that image contrast is an actual root cause. So that localized part of the puzzle is definitely identified by the model, and that's where you can identify a root cause in case of image classification.
Right. All right, I think I've gotcha. So getting back to the data, obviously you need a ton of it to be able to do any of this. So, how have you been ensuring that your data sets are robust enough and matching, you're able to decode and figure out where, data governance is where I'm going with that. How are you making sure that everybody's data matches enough so that you can actually do stuff with it?
Yes, that's a great question. And so in any AI project, the data quality is of utmost important for us. So in our team at Invista, we establish robust data quality checks thanks to the dedicated efforts by our architecture team and the data engineering team. So what these checks do is that they safeguard, and in the event of any failure, both the data engineering team as well as our architecture team are promptly alerted through a notification via various channels. It could be Teams channel or it could be an email. So whenever their metrics fall apart, they are automatically notified. And they collaborate effectively, they organize sessions or meetings together and address and resolve any data quality issue that may arise. So that's how we employ. So definitely our team, we have a very good or a great team, I should say that, where everything is promptly taken care of and the data quality is definitely maintained.
Okay. And so as you're rolling out tools to individuals and teams, how are you approaching making sure that each team has tools that are going to be useful for them, that people are actually using the tools that you're giving them and they know how to do it? How have you been doing that?
Yeah, so there are always, in the ever evolving world of AI, there is always a new tool that emerges. frequently. Yesterday, I mean, if you guys are aware of it, there is a new generative AI model called Gemini from Google, which is on par with the new OpenAI's ChatGPT-4. So there is always something new that's coming in, and it is always challenging for us to stay updated. But at Invista, we have dedicated teams responsible for vetting out these tools to ensure that they are secure, safeguarded, and are away from any potential data leakages. So we have a really great team for that. And also we establish contractual agreements with these tool vendors, which adds extra layer of protection to our data. And before any tool is made available to our employees, it must go through this approval process by specialized teams. And only then the tools are, given to individuals. The stringent process ensures that the tools that we are using are not only cutting edge, but also safe and reliable. So that's how we roll out new tools to individuals and teams.
Okay. And so once you give them to the individuals, what kind of support are they getting?
So in terms of training, is that the question? So yeah, we definitely, before rolling out any tools, we have a lot of training material. We schedule monthly meetings. So we have a dedicated team who trains our employees on these tools. Definitely, there are various communities, channels throughout our broader Cook community where they can ask questions, reach out to individuals. There we can also schedule individual training sessions. There are also Q&A panels for that. So once that's the beauty of being a part of a larger organization, right? So we make sure that all the levels, we make sure that there is a documentation ready before the tool is passed to individuals, so that once we have the documentation, it makes easier, right, for our employers or colleagues to refer to the documentation and learn about the tool.
Okay. All right. Yep. So now this is our last question that we have planned. So if anyone wants to get their questions into the chat or start raising their hands, now's the time. But this is where you can kind of start to speculate and dream a little. So where do you see these tools going? What are some things that you're excited about for the future with AI tools?
Yeah, so we cannot. So with the rapid growth of AI means that the older tools become obsolete or the newer tools become obsolete rather swiftly. So predicting which tool, will stand the test of time in the next few years is really challenging. So we can never predict what's going to happen. I would say, the new tool that Google released yesterday, which is Gemini, could overpower OpenAI's ChatGPT or GPT-4 in the next month. There is a beautiful or a wonderful video from Google's Gemini, that performs real-time predictions, where even if you draw a picture, it gives you an answer in real-time. So imagine our future at this point where given an image or given a text, if it is doing things in real-time, it makes most of the AI tools that we talked about obsolete within next month. However, I would say it is crucial and crucial to stay vigilant and keep eye on updates and new features of the tools continuously being integrated with those tools. So if there is a new tool that's coming or a new technology that's coming in, if the older tool is getting updated with those new features, it means that you can trust the tool for a while. And that's how you can ensure that these features are up to date, aligned, and evolving aligned with the evolving landscape of AI, which is essential for these tools. If it is not evolving, then definitely, I would suggest skipping to a new tool or researching another tool, because having a new tool with new features and updated features is essential. But one should also keep security in mind while handling such tools. So I would say by doing the necessary research, we can adapt and harness the full potential of these tools in a rapidly changing field.
All right, looks like I've got to go and check out Gemini.
Yep, definitely. You guys have to watch the video.
I do. The key question is it going to help me help my children with their algebra homework better? Because that is a huge function of ChatGPT for me.
Definitely does. I have also seen in that video, if you give a question paper as an input, it automatically gives you the Python code. If you ask it to do algebra, it does it. It can also, you can also talk to it to perform analysis. So you can also ask it, how did you approach this solution? What different steps you took? So it's a multi-model. When I say multi-model, it can take text, voice, and video or vision as an input to give you an output. So you can interact with it just like a human would.
I could upload their worksheets. I wouldn't have to type in the individual problems anymore. And just to be clear, everyone, I am not doing the homework for them. It's just so that I can help explain it to them. Sometimes we forget what algebra is like in seventh grade. So there we are. Anyway, thanks, Chitra. So what questions do all of you have for Chitra? I warned you, we were getting into the weeds on this one. We're figuring out how this stuff actually works. So this is your time. I'm going to start asking more questions about algebra here.
Well, I was waiting for others to chime in here, but this is Tazio from Caterpillar. Just because I'm curious about this one, we were banned from using ChatGTP at CAT, right, when it came out, because there were, call it horror stories, right, of people getting results, which then included other people's copyrighted information or patented information. And I forget which big, you know, Fortune 100 company it was that got into trouble. But, you know, when the security people see that, they put a big hold on the whole thing. Right. And so when we do any work with a generative model, we have to be very aware of what we're asking and how. Right. And then what results we get, we have to vet those. So just curious as to your thoughts on the risk going forward of people, you know, getting results that seem great, but they aren't yours, you know, that they belong to someone else.
That's a very valid point. I can talk about our organization. Within Invista, we have built-in tools like Everlearn and Coke GPT. So how we work is that, so we employ RAGs. I mean, have you guys heard of RAGs, which is nothing but, so if you have to give you a layman example, so it performs similar to ChatGPT, but it only provides results on your data and it doesn't reach out to the internet. It only works with the data that you have and it doesn't go out of the boundaries that you have set. And that's how we as a team, or the beauty of Coke Industries is that we have set boundaries with ChatGPT so that it doesn't reach or go to the other external websites to pull information. We employ our internal data, our data sources, and then pull results accordingly based on what we need. So that's how we employ security. So that as I told you before, we have dedicated teams to do all the necessary security checks document stuff and various other protocols that are required so that we are not copyrighted and we don't fall into that trap. So that's how we do. I'm not sure about how other organizations work, so I cannot comment on those.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I have heard that other organizations are taking a similar approach to kind of ring fencing their own information.
Yeah.
And another question from Muhammad Iqbal. So did you have to train the model to only your internal data?
Definitely right. It depends on the use case that you are working on. In some cases, we might need external data, but through a reliable source. Even if we use external data, it has to go through our security checks. We have to see how authentic the vendor that we're working with is. And only then we use the data on our models. So that's, it depends. At the end of the day, I would say it depends on the use case, but definitely we have various level of protocols when we use external data. But most of our data is internal. But if use case comes up where we had to use external data, we would. For sure.
Okay. And so along those lines, Randy Ball asks, how are use cases selected or vetted for utilizing new AI/ML, LLM, generative AI tools and technology at Invista?
So since Invista is a part of a larger group organizations, right? We have yearly meetings, community gatherings, where we talk about various ideas. And also we talk to various members within our organization, ask their various pain points throughout their day-to-day work life. And if there is a real need, so any generative AI, I mean, if you have to use, if I think the question is specifically about LLMs, generative AIs, AI. So yeah, definitely asking your stakeholders or your fellow colleagues and talking about what their pain points are, how they approach various manual, I mean, if there are any manual tasks, you definitely want to automate that, right? So we employ something called a red curve, green curve, where red curve is where we want to minimize our manual labor and automate the process so that it can free up our time and become more productive on other tasks. So I would suggest keep questioning, ask for what the pain points are through in a day-to-day life and see if they can be automated through AI, large language. If there is a generative AI use case, use generative, solve that problem using generative AI. One simple example I could give you is, imagine you have a lot of text and someone in your organization is reading a lot of text data, but you don't want them to spend time reading articles that are not important, right? So you can ask a generative AI model to summarize such articles. And at that point, once you read the summary, you might not feel it's important and definitely you can skip that article, right? So that's one of the use cases or ideas that you can generate. It all depends on the way you ask your individuals or your team questions. And based on those, you can have your ideas generated or use cases generated, or maybe ask your ChatGPT to give you some ideas. So, I don't know. Yeah.
All right. I think we've got time for one more question. Does anyone want to jump in? A second to type it in there if that's where you're going with that.
Is somebody typing something or can I go?
Go for it, Tazia. They're okay. Too slow typing.
All right. One of the graphs I've seen lately was the cost to train a large language model. And interestingly, the cost was depicted not really in dollars, but in energy required. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at what a vast sum of energy, amount of energy was required to train. And it was GTP3, not the 4, right? And I assume 4 is like multitudes higher. Mm-hmm. And on the same graph, it showed, you know, a human's entire like energy consumption for the year. And GTP3 was like 500 times that amount. And again, with GTP4 being more than that. And the fact that they're working on ever more advanced, you know, models. Mm-hmm. This is probably a silly question, but is it worth all that energy cost-wise, right? To make whatever advancements people are think they're going to get from, you know, the generative AI?
Definitely there is a trade-off when it comes to cost, right? So if you have to specifically talk about, if you want to specifically train, I mean, I can talk about a number of things, but imagine if you want you to train your model on using a generative AI model, definitely you don't want to do that because it could cost you millions and trillions of dollars to train a model. And if you want to deploy that, it's another ask. But one should always welcome innovation. There are organizations that employ, that spend millions of dollars to enable, generative AI models. But they have also come up with something called a retrieval augmentation generation model. So that doesn't require you to train on your own data set. Rather, it can gather information from the data source that you already have and treat it as a new source and give you information that is very close to something that you already trained on. So in this way, the cost is reduced, but you should always welcome innovation, even though it is costly, is how I would look at. I hope I answered your question, but why should you stop innovation when there is an opportunity, right? So imagine if OpenAI hasn't invested millions and trillions of dollars on generating ChatGPT or any generative AI model. Imagine how much manual task that we as an organization have to do, to arrive at a solution. So it is making our lives easier, right? At the end of the day. So that's how I would look at positive. I always like to be positive when it comes to innovation. Yeah.
All right. And we got one last question.
How do you measure success, right? So how do you measure the effectiveness of the, you know, tools that you have launched out, and how are you monitoring that as a function of time? It kind of leans on the previous question as well, in terms of the cost, the sunk cost that you have in training the AI.
So at Invista or at Coke, we always measure we always measure success based on the usage of the models. So we build hundreds of models, but it doesn't make sense if our stakeholders are not using it at the end of the day. So we don't want to do that. So we schedule various meetings. We have recurrent meetings with our stakeholders to see if they are really interested in the models that we build. If they are not, we are open to quitting.
Have you gone the next iteration where you've measured the productivity of your people as a result of implementing the tools?
Sure. So in the text classification use case that I've talked about,
I joined late because I got a.
Oh, oh sorry.
An emergency call, so I missed that aspect. I apologize.
Yeah, we have gone an extra mile with our stakeholders. If he's interested, we are ready to go to any extent. Because it is end of the day, it is solving his problem, right? So our stakeholder success is our success. So we would definitely go to a next any stage to make sure that his life is easier and give us
good profit at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. One last question snuck in here. So what is AI's capability on working with optical illusions? And that's just kind of a fun one.
Optical illusion. What kind of optical illusion are you referring to, if I may ask?
I don't know, but I'm picturing those ones from the 90s where you had to make your eyes go fuzzy in order to see a sailboat. But I'm guessing that is not where we're going with that.
See, AI models are not 100% positive, right? We can never get 100% accurate. I would like to talk about one good example that one of our team member has worked on. It's to identify the drift of the fireball within our boiler system. So it's more like an illusion system, you know, where you don't know what position the fire is inside the boiler. But if the fire hits the edges of the boiler, it could create a lot of financial loss for us. So we deployed a computer vision system we have used various OpenAI techniques like cropping the image, finding the coordinates of the fireball. If the fireball has drifted to the right, then the usual position, we notify it. So that's one of the illusion. I wouldn't call it an illusion system, but it's one of the computer vision system that's very close to illusion, because you do not have a lateral or a complete 360 degree view of the fireball, right? When you look at an image, it's always a flat image. It's always a 2D and not a 3D, and we don't know whether the fireball is shifted up or down. So that makes it very challenging. But so this is one of the very beautiful use case of the computer vision to identify where the fireball has drifted based on the coordinates of the image or the fireball. So I would say one has to be very innovative and you should always think out of the box while handling problems with optical illusion, because not all the problems cannot be solved through AI, but it all depends on your pre-processing techniques that make your solutions better. So as in the fireball example, no one would have thought about having a coordinate access system solving the problem, right? It's not completely an AI solution, AI problem, but it's more like a team member has converted an AI problem into a simple coordinate access use case and helped solve the fireball issue and helped Invista save millions and millions of dollars. So yes, you have to be innovative and think differently when handling such illusion problems, because AI can create problems because it's not as intelligent as we are, but we try to make it intelligent at the end of the day. So if we are smart, AI will be smart because we train on what we know, right, at the end of the day.
All right. And that's a good point to end it on, I think. Fireballs, always exciting. So, Chitra, thank you so much for joining us and being in the hot seat. Oh, in different respects, fireball there. Sure. So thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for joining and for your questions. Mm-hmm. And everyone have a wonderful holiday season. And I will see you in the new year.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining.
Thank you.